Good morning, everyone. My name's Jim Fander. I'm a professor of law at the of Illinois, and I'm sitting in this morning for David Inge, the regular host of Focus 580. Joining me in the studio is my colleague on the law faculty, Professor Andrew Leopold. Professor Leopold clerked for Justice Lewis Powell back in the 1980s and knows the inner workings of the court as well as anyone. Welcome, Andy.
Thanks.
Today, as we've done in the past, Andy and I will be conducting a review of the work of the Supreme Court during the year that ended in late June with the announcement of the decision of the Supreme Court in the military tribunal case Hamdan versus Rumsfeld. I think we both agree that the year will be best remembered for a few high-profile decisions and for the arrival of two new justices, Chief Justice John Roberts and Associate Justice Samuel Alito. We plan to spend a little bit of time this morning discussing how these new justices might influence the court's work, and then we'll take up some of the year's leading cases, perhaps take a quick look at what lies ahead in the coming year. As always, we'd be delighted to hear from listeners, and if you have a question or a comment, please give us a call. The numbers are 333-9455, and if you're calling from outside the local calling area, the toll-free number is 800-222-9455. First, Andy, let's chat for a moment about Chief Justice Roberts. Obviously, President Bush was much taken with Roberts. He nominated him first to fill Justice O'Connor's seat and then tapped him as the new Chief Justice when William Rehnquist died. We often think of the Chief as a very symbol of the court, and so one hears a great deal about Chief Justice John Marshall and Chief Justice Earl Warren. Perhaps you can tell us just a bit about the role of the Chief and how that influences the work of the court.
The role of the chief is in some ways quite powerful and in some ways not powerful at all. As you know, the chief has no more vote than anyone else. He's just one of nine and can only influence his colleagues through persuasion, just like any other justice. On the other hand, the chief justice has the power of assignment, which means that after the justices reveal their votes at conference, after they hear a case, it's up to the chief, if he's in the majority, to decide who will write the opinion. Now, this is can be a very delicate task, in part because you want to give everyone a fair share of the work, in part because you want to give all justices a fair share of the big cases. There are a number of important cases and a number of cases that are significant to the parties but otherwise unremarkable.
Can you think of an example of a situation in which the strategic assignment of the opinion might influence either the outcome of a particular case or the future course of the court's work?
Sure. Let's take a case where after conference it appears it's going to be a 5-4 decision.
And the conference is the meeting of the justices that takes place after they hear oral argument in the case.
Exactly right. And now it's time for the chief to decide who can write an opinion. Now, by definition, the chief is in the majority, and so he has to decide who is most likely to write an opinion that will keep all five justices on board. So he has to sift through and think, well, who has the most moderate position? Because if he assigns it to the wrong justice who writes something quite aggressive, some of the other members of the five may peel off, and then the majority shifts to the other side. So the chief needs to be very careful in big cases trying to figure out who's going to keep the court, who's going to keep the five votes intact.
And do you have a sense of where that center of gravity is and how a justice might lose a court in a close case? How would that happen?
Well, if a justice writes an opinion that is hoped to be the majority opinion, he or she will then circulate it to the full court. And then the votes start coming in. And what sometimes happens is if your justice is writing, you get three votes very quickly. So it's your justice and three. You need one more. The last justice who might join you knows this and so might send a memo to your chamber saying, I would like to join your opinion, but you need to take out part four, which I find unnecessary to the case. Now it's up to the justice to decide, do I keep part four, which I think is really important, or do I drop part four to get that fifth vote? And that kind of interplay or that kind of strategic thinking goes on all the time.
given that a lot of the strategic work goes on in the actual production of opinions, in particular majority opinions, what is the role of the conference and how would the arrival of a new Chief Justice affect that process?
The conference is much less a deliberative process than I think most people think, including most new justices when they join the court. Justice Scalia, for example, has said publicly that he was surprised at how little actually argument goes on in the conference. Usually it's just a stating of positions rather than a back and forth. So the new chief needs, of course, to let everyone state their positions, but could, if he were of a mind to, allow a little bit more full discussion than just, here's how I vote and here's why.
Another thing that the Chief Justice does is oversee the judicial conference or the judicial bureaucracy, and many people recognize that the Chief Justice has a role to play in appointing members of that bureaucracy and in appointing members of particular or specialized courts. One of the courts over which the Chief Justice has appointing power is the so-called FISA Court, or Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act Court, the court that sits to oversee disputes over the scope of foreign intelligence gathering by the FBI. How could the Chief Justice's role as the appointing power over that court influence, for example, the development of national security law?
Oh, it could in a very large way. I mean, I don't want to say it's more important than what he does with his colleagues on the court, but the ability to choose the judges who will sit on the specialized court, and it's no criticism of Chief Justice Roberts or anyone else to say he is probably inclined to pick judges who share his worldview, who he thinks are sensible and have a proper respect for the role of the judiciary and so on. So it could be a very large influence, and that's one of the real, I don't want to say hidden powers, but one of the less discussed powers of the chief.
Given that the court, as we have seen and as the Chief Justice does, works primarily by voting on the outcome of particular cases, I wonder if there's a lesson there for the confirmation process. Many people treat the confirmation of justices, the nomination and confirmation of justices, as if it is a process of picking people who will vote in your favor on particular cases. And so you can see the senators, for example, lining up in the confirmation process according to their prediction about the outcome of justices' prospective votes on particular issues that are of concern to that senator or that constituency. How true is it that the votes of the justices are well predicted at the time of confirmation? And is that a factor that ought to play a role in the confirmation process? It seems inevitably that it will. How important is it to appoint and confirm judges that are good lawyers as well as just voters?
Well, I think it's extraordinarily important to pick justices who are good lawyers, good legal technicians, in part because when you talk about the hot button issues about which we all care and we all try to predict how Justice Alito is going to rule on this issue, the affirmative action, death penalty, and so on. But the work of the court is so much more than that. That's one thing. And justices change. It's hard to follow the careers of any justice on the Supreme Court without getting the profound sense that they grow into the office or are changed by the office, or perhaps the court changes around them and so today's conservative is tomorrow's liberal or vice versa. So you're right, it's inevitable, but is it a lot more than that? You bet.
Your story about change reminds me of the close affiliation between Justice Blackmun and then Chief Justice Berger when the two of them first arrived as newly appointed justices on the court. They were sometimes referred to as the Minnesota Twins because they were so closely aligned politically and otherwise. And over time, those two jurists grew apart, both personally and judicially. This term, interestingly enough, the statistics for the term reveal that the two most closely aligned justices in divided cases were the two newest members, that is to say, Chief Justice Roberts and Justice Alito. They voted together 91% of the time in contested cases. And I wonder if your comment about evolution and growth may be relevant in assessing their future.
Oh, I think it must be, in part because what's important to the court changes, people change, the composition of the court changes around them, and so they may find themselves aligned here but not here 2 years later or 5 years later as the type of issue changes. It's also, I think, too early, particularly with respect to Justice Alito, to get too much of a read on him. He joined the court late in the term. The docket was set. Many of the cases had been argued, which is not to say that he won't continue to vote consistently with Chief Justice Roberts. If I had to predict over the next 5 years, I would say, yeah, he's likely to. But you can't follow the career of any long-timers without getting a sense of change.
Let me remind our listeners of the phone numbers. If you're calling locally, it's 333-9455 and toll-free 800-222-9455. We have a caller on line 4 from Bloomington, Indiana. Go ahead.
Hi. The Supreme Court has set itself up as the chief arbiter of the Constitution. What if Congress were to say this is Congress by overwhelming vote is to say this is what we think the Constitution means, and we have just as much right to say it as the Supreme Court does, as an equal branch of the government. And I want you to comment on that, but just let me another little comment. Recently, I believe the Congress, it's one of the houses, passed a bill saying this the Supreme or the court system. I think the Supreme Court had no jurisdiction as to whether the Pledge of Allegiance should contain the phrase "under God" or not. In other words, here is the Congress expressing its ability to interpret the Constitution equal to the Supreme Court. Comment, please.
Andy's going to respond to the first part of the inquiry about the relationship between the court in respect of overwhelmingly passed legislation by Congress.
The Congress can certainly do that. And they, when it comes to the Constitution, however, even if Congress said it is our overwhelming sense that abortion is not protected by the Constitution, for example.
Yes.
The Supreme Court still has and will continue to have the last word on what the Constitution says.
Only because they have seized it, though. There isn't any real constitutional provision that gives them the last word, is there?
Well, there's no constitutional provision that says, and the Supreme Court gets the last word, but it has been true throughout our history that the Supreme Court, I guess you could say they seized it, but they seized it in a way that has been now well settled for a couple hundred years. But let me just make one other sort of observation about that. The Supreme Court is not oblivious to what Congress does. The abortion example may be a bad one when it comes to this, but if Congress very strongly takes a position on something, that matters to the court. They try to be respectful of Congress's role in and try to some extent, limit their own role when it comes to deciding questions of policy. But interpretation of the Constitution, courts got it, and they're going to keep it.
There are two other things that we might say, and the first is that if you have overwhelming support in the Congress of the United States for a particular position, it could often give rise to a constitutional amendment that would enjoy the support of the many states that are necessary for its ratification. So that's one response. Another response is to say that if the Congress of the United States is overwhelmingly aligned, as you indicate, over time, the jurists appointed to the Supreme Court will tend to reflect that political consensus. And so the views of the court may well change through the confirmation of justices who seem to share that overwhelming view. So that may be a way in which, even though the court nominally has the authority to stand firm in the face of political opposition, it really has, in a sense, an obligation to bow to the changing political winds. And I think that is what reflects or what leads to the change in the nature of judicial decision-making over time.
Do you have any objection to the Congress asserting its constitutional power by saying, courts, you have no jurisdiction. When we say one nation under God and our Pledge of Allegiance, you may not hear any case. You may not hear a case concerning that matter.
That's a very interesting question, and one that the Supreme Court has so far not yet decided. The Article III provision of the Constitution authorizes the Supreme Court to exercise appellate jurisdiction, but then says subject to the exceptions and regulations that Congress may make. Many people read the exceptions and regulations clause just as you do, to permit the Congress of the United States to restrict the court's jurisdiction over particular issues such as the Pledge of Allegiance or perhaps school busing or perhaps affirmative action or perhaps abortion. There is some support in the court's own decisions that it will not willingly conclude or readily conclude that Congress has taken that step. And the reason is that many people believe that jurisdiction stripping of that kind is unlikely to succeed and could lead to results that are worse than the results that would be achieved through the evolution of the court's own doctrine in that area. Just to give you a couple of examples of what critics have said in response to proposals to restrict jurisdiction, some have said that it would be a mistake because it would produce a constitution that means different things in different parts of the country, because the state courts would, by definition, have the last word on the meaning of the Constitution in all those cases, like the Pledge of Allegiance case, that have been eliminated from the court's appellate docket. So there might be some variability from state to state in the interpretation or meaning of the Constitution. The Supreme Court plays a number of roles, and one of the roles it plays is the role of unifying the interpretation of federal law on the theory that we should have a single body of supreme federal law in the United States. And court stripping, to some extent, is seen as potentially problematic on policy grounds for that reason. Another response might be to say that a restriction on the court's own jurisdiction might tend to freeze in place law made by the Supreme Court that would evolve if the court's own appellate jurisdiction remained intact. So if the court has some precedents on the books that seem to suggest that there may be a problem with the reference to under God and the pledge, perhaps the thing to do is to get cases onto the court's docket that will enable the court to moderate the influence of those precedents if that's the appropriate result, or to overrule them in appropriate cases, or to confirm them in appropriate cases. But if the court is denied jurisdiction, it may not have power to do either one. Thank you very much for the comments. We're going to hear now from a listener on line one from Champaign County.
All right. I don't want to divert on the pledge too long, but that under God was added in the 50s, and I believe it was in the middle of the World War II that the Jehovah's Witnesses were allowed not to stand during the Pledge of Allegiance. It just seems like the mindset of the time was so needs to be unpacked a little bit. I actually was going to call first about the fact that I think statistically the court is split. I think they've had as many as six different opinions issued on some things, and that contrary to their first unanimous ruling, they actually the Roberts Court in the first year is actually I think I heard this on NPR that it's statistically it's got a very all over the place kind of he hasn't been bringing them all together, as it were. But what I really wanted to talk about was what the ABA just issued this rather amazing report on the signing statements, and I just wanted you to comment on, since Alito was apparently the person that drafted the rationale for signing statements in the during when he was an underling at the in the Reagan administration, and Roberts has this sort of sympathy to unitary executive theory. Where do you think we're going on that kind of issue? Because this is a fundamental constitutional issue, it seems to me, that whether the president can veto or not veto, or whether he can put asterisks on all the clauses.
Those are great questions.
Thank you very much.
Yes. In terms of the statistics from the recent term just ended, there were about half of the decisions came down unanimously. There were 69 total or full opinions from the court. And that's about average. So the number of unanimous decisions didn't really increase this year. It's about at average. There were 16 decisions that were decided by a narrow five-justice majority, either five to four or five 5-3. And again, that's about an average number of closely divided decisions. So, and at the end of the term, of course, there are a number of these six-part opinions that are very hard to parse, of the kind that we've grown quite familiar with. So in some respects, I think the listener is correct that this year looks somewhat like other years, although there were some very controversial decisions that the court was able to sidestep, Andy.
Well, the best example of that probably is an abortion case that came from New Hampshire, which was, I can't say that it was Justice O'Connor's last opinion, but it had to be pretty close to her last opinion. And what happened not only in that case, but in other cases, I think, was the court was largely marching in place. It was a year of transition, a new chief and a new member of the court that came on basically at mid-year. And so whenever you see the Supreme Court 9-0 on an abortion decision, and it ended up being an extraordinarily narrow opinion that only talked about the remedy and didn't even talk very much about that, it makes me think that the court is really catching its collective breath and the real time to measure whether the court is fragmented or unified is next term rather than this one.
In terms of the caller's question about signing statements, yes, Senator Spector from Pennsylvania has been quite interested in the issue and is proposing legislation that would authorize the Congress to sue the president, quite an unusual measure, one that the president might veto, one assumes, but allowing the Congress of the United States to sue the president to challenge the legitimacy or constitutionality of signing statements. And one's first response to that proposed legislation is to ask, what is the basis for the suit? Does Congress have standing to sue the president in this sort of case? And what kind of relief would a court order? Ordinarily, when cases come before courts, they come before courts because an individual has a concrete grievance with someone. And so there are questions, I think, to be raised about whether Senator Spector's initiative could produce a court test of the signing statement phenomenon. The problem is that there's no other obvious way to secure a court test, because if what the president has said in these cases is, I'm not going to enforce the law because I think the law is wrong or unconstitutional, he won't bring the action, criminal or civil, that would produce a test of the question whether he is acting correctly or incorrectly in refusing to enforce it. I think a better strategy for Congress might be to authorize individuals to bring actions to enforce laws privately, and make the claim that those laws are enforceable, notwithstanding the fact that the president has issued a signing statement saying that he and the executive branch won't enforce them. And that would present an issue for the courts that they could resolve concerning the relationship between the individual's right to enforce a right conferred by Congress and the president's power to take the air out of that right by issuing a signing statement. But you're quite right that this is an area that has gained additional notoriety recently, especially in light of the ABA's lengthy study of the question. One more caller, this one from Coles County on line 4. Hello?
Yes, I just wanted to mention something. It seems to me that the most incredible civil liberties problem that the American people have had in recent decades is the fact that they have a president of the United States right now who actually claims that he has the power to hold American citizens, and of course non-citizens, incommunicado. In other words, that they can be held without charges, without trial, without attorney, without even having any contact with relatives, and without the public or the press even knowing about it. Now, I realize the courts probably won't uphold this, and I know some of this is, the Supreme Court has dealt with some of this. But I don't know if you're giving your opinion, but wouldn't you agree that it's scary, even though the president of the United States has claimed such power, is really very scary, unless you can't give your opinion at all. But I like your comment on that.
Well, the listener's question is a good one, and obviously the concerns with both the detention of enemy combatants at Guantanamo Bay and the use of the so-called extraordinary rendition program to pick people up perhaps on the streets of Italy or the streets of other countries around the world and transfer them under the aegis of the CIA to undisclosed locations for questioning and so on, raises grave civil liberties questions. I think the best way to get into the issue of the legality of those sorts of presidentially authorized detention programs is to take a look at a case that we intended to spend some time on this morning, and that's the case of Hamdan against Rumsfeld, probably the best-known case of the term. As you know, the case grows out of the detention of combatants at Guantanamo Bay and was adopted pursuant to a policy that President Bush created by executive order after September 11th. And enemy combatants are those that the government perhaps captured during the Afghanistan fighting or in Iraq and have suspected ties to al-Qaeda. President Bush's order claims the power to detain these combatants indefinitely and to try them before military commissions. And these commissions are not courts-martial in the traditional sense, and they do not adhere to the same rules of procedure as civilian courts, for example, hearsay evidence, the right to meet and confront witnesses against you, and so forth. 2 years ago, the detention at Guantanamo Bay produced two notable Supreme Court decisions. In one, Razul against Bush, the court ruled that detainees had the right to petition the federal courts for review of their confinement through the writ of habeas corpus. Now, obviously, the right to petition depends to some extent on having access to counsel, and the Guantanamo Bay detainees do have some access to counsel that would not necessarily be afforded to those who've been subjected to the extraordinary rendition program. In both decisions, the other case, of course, was Hamdi against Rumsfeld, involving a U.S. citizen held in the United States who was held to be entitled to certain due process protections in determining whether he was, in fact, an enemy combatant or not. So in both those decisions, the court pushed back a bit against the assertion of presidential power. This year, Salim Hamdan, a former driver apparently of Osama bin Laden, challenged the proposal to subject him to trial before a military commission. And the government argued two things. The court should refrain from hearing the case, both on statutory and policy grounds, and that in any case the tribunals were a recognized mode of punishing those found to have engaged in unlawful conduct. And of course, the decision has attracted a great deal of attention. Andy, what did the court actually do in the Hamdan case?
Boy, that's a great question. I'm not sure that anybody knows for sure all the implications of the court decision, but here's what the court did and here's what it didn't do. What it did do is, to borrow your phrase, it pushed back. It said, in effect, Congress has to have a role if the president wants to use these military commissions. And in fact, in Justice Breyer's very short concurring opinion, he has this line, Congress has not issued the executive a blank check. And that, I think, captures a lot of what's going on here. The details are important, but far beyond the details is the court's conclusion that what the president wants to do has to be authorized, and it has to be authorized by Congress somehow. Now, that does, and so here's what the court didn't do. It didn't say that the president can't have military commissions to try people at Guantanamo Bay. It didn't say that you can't try people for conspiracy, because one of Hamdan's claims was conspiracy is not a crime of war. What it said at root was the president has to follow procedures in doing what he wants to do. Maybe he can do them, maybe he can't. That remains to be seen. And there's a lot of congressional action right now churning about what the president is authorized to do. But the clear message of Hamdan, even though there was only a majority for parts of the opinion, was you have to be authorized to do it. And right now, the president isn't authorized to do this. He's authorized to do other things, but not these types of things that you describe.
Right. So the immediate consequence of the Hamdan decision is to invalidate the use of military commissions as configured in the executive order that was issued just after 9/11. And that, again, puts the issue back into Congress's lap to determine what sorts of process should be afforded the individuals and whether that process should comport with the Geneva Convention and its various provisions or not. And one of the questions that the Hamdan decision presents is the question of whether the treatment of detainees up to this point may be seen as inconsistent with the requirements of the Geneva Convention that the court viewed as applicable to this case. And as listeners know, I think the Geneva Convention, at least Common Article 3, imposes some limitations that were said to be applicable to this conflict, that is to say, the conflict with al-Qaeda. President Bush had taken the position that members of al-Qaeda were not entitled to those protections because the conflict was not of an international character and was not brought within the scope of the Geneva protections. So part of what the court did was to invalidate the particular tribunals, and part of what it did was to suggest that the legislation that has been adopted to date, the Uniform Code of Military Justice, the authorization for the use of military force in the wake of 9/11, that none of these statutes authorize the particular form of tribunals that President Bush had created to try the folks at Guantanamo. But the broader implications of the decision are potentially significant as well, because in this case, the court emphasized, or at least the majority opinion emphasized, the importance of complying with the law and read the law rather broadly to include both congressional enactments and Geneva Convention provisions. So in the absence of some legislation by Congress that cuts back on the scope of that body of law, then presumably a number of protections may be available to those members of al-Qaeda or others who are caught up in the war on terrorism. For example, the Geneva Conventions prevent the use of cruel and degrading treatment in interrogation, and that might apply not only to people at Guantanamo Bay but to others, to those detained elsewhere. So in response to the listener and in sort of assessing the significance of the opinion, I think one answer is to say we don't know exactly how far the court's commitment to the Geneva Conventions goes in terms of its extension beyond those detained at Guantanamo Bay, but at least it poses a question about the possibility that some of the items that the listener identified as matters of particular concern from a civil liberties perspective may be addressed by the court's decision. Certainly, the court has taken the position that the president can't claim inherent authority as the commander-in-chief to engage in many of these detention strategies, but has to look, as Andy said, for support from the Congress of the United States. And it's that legislative process, really, that is unfolding as we speak. We have a listener on line one from Urbana. Go ahead.
Hello?
Yes, you're on.
Oh, okay. I'm sorry. My question was to do with the preemptive war and the – is there any congressional issues or any constitutional issues, I mean, that involve the preemptive war? It seems like it's really weakened us politically in a lot of ways and internationally, but I'm wondering if there's any constitutional issues.
The idea, for example, that only Congress has the power to declare war and not the president?
Well, no, I'm thinking that they declared this new style of thing, that we were going to go find the terrorists, and if we decided we wanted to attack somebody, we would. We could do it preemptive of them striking. And I think that internationally there are people who have done it. Israel has done it, and it seemed like Russia kind of did that, used that same idea to attack Chechnya. And my thought was, that seems to be just a concept that's kind of wrong based on what our country is based on.
We have tended to fight defensive wars for the most part, but there are a number of occasions in which we have struck out in some ways. On the question of authorization, it seems to me that the authorization for the use of military force that Congress adopted after 9/11 goes a long way towards authorizing the steps that have been taken. That is a very broadly phrased authorization. I think the listener may be right that there's a political issue to be raised about the decision to engage in preemptive war. But I think it's perhaps difficult to frame that in constitutional terms in light of the scope of the authorization that Congress adopted. Andy?
Yeah, the court's role tends to play itself out exactly as it is here. Detainees, people who are incarcerated, I mean, things from which the court can has some familiarity and can get their arms around. The court's ability to marshal some kind of constitutional remedy to what is overwhelmingly, in the court's view, a political question is very small. I mean, it's hard for me to imagine the court, and you read the opinions to which Jim referred in the Hamdan decision, and you can see how terribly uncomfortable the court is even now, even at the core, talking about people who are being detained without charges and without counsel and without seeing the evidence. even then, the court is trying to tread very lightly because it knows that the questions of war and peace and attacks are not anything within its competence.
There were a number of occasions during the Vietnam War when courts were invited to interfere with the exercise of military force, either because it had the conflict wasn't adequately authorized or for other reasons, and the courts were very reluctant to get involved in those cases as well.
Except for Justice Douglas, but yeah.
Do you want to tell that story, Andy?
Well, Justice Douglas, the story is told that he was willing to listen to claims that certain military actions were illegal, and at one point apparently was prepared to issue an order that would effectively halt the Vietnam War in place until some of the other members of the court decided that that really wasn't the proper role of the Supreme Court.
But the larger point is the one that Andy made earlier, and that is the old saying is that in times of war, the laws are silent. And if not silent, they speak with a muted voice. And I think as this conflict has lingered on, it now runs perhaps longer than World War II did, the courts may be speaking with a somewhat more vigorous voice. But in the early days, certainly after conflicts break out, the courts are very unlikely to get involved and to find ways to stay out. We also wanted to talk today about recent developments in the criminal procedure world, and there were two cases decided this term that govern procedures that police must follow in pursuing criminal activity. One dealt with the use of the exclusionary rule in knock-and-announce cases, and one dealt with the authority of individuals living in a house to consent to the search of the premises on behalf of others. Andy?
Well, the knock-and-announce case, and by knock-and-announce, all I mean is 11 years ago, the Supreme Court decided that the Fourth Amendment, which prohibits unreasonable searches and seizures, includes a requirement that the police who want to execute a warrant in your home can't just break down the door and come in without knocking and announcing their presence, giving you time to answer the door. There are exceptions, of course. If they hear the toilet flush 71 times after they knock, they can go in immediately because they think evidence is being destroyed. But in general, the police have to knock and announce. In a case coming from Michigan called Hudson, the police didn't. They actually waited 3 to 5 seconds and then entered the house after knocking. But everyone agreed that was not enough time. And so the question was, what's the remedy? The importance of Hudson is that the court said the exclusionary rule, which, as all those who watch Law and Order know, means that if the evidence is seized in an illegal search, it can't be used to prove someone's guilt. The exclusionary rule doesn't apply to violations of the knock-and-announce rule, said the Supreme Court in a very close decision. And I think this reaches back a little bit to what one of the other listeners was talking about and what Jim responded to about how the composition of the court changes. The exclusionary rule, the idea that you keep out evidence that somebody committed the crime and can't admit it in court, is one that's been very controversial over the years. Probably the legislative composition has changed over the years in ways that led to different justices being appointed. And in fact, in this case, it appears that the court was split 4-4, waiting for Justice Alito. Justice Alito joined the court, and then it was 5-4 to say, no, we're not going to apply the exclusionary rule in this case. So that's an example, I think, of the court's composition changing the outcome in cases. And what I think it portends for the future is it shows a willingness of the Supreme Court, perhaps, to go after one of the very basic premises of search and seizure law, which is the exclusionary rule is what we do when the police step out of bounds.
And part of the rethinking of that use of the exclusionary rule involved a reliance on alternative remedies. Andy, perhaps you could give us a sense of what those alternative remedies might be and how effective you think they might be.
Well, the court said that we have no reason to doubt that civil remedies, meaning the people whose house got stormed into, can always sue the police civilly. I think that's not a good option because police typically have qualified immunity unless they violate clear law. And boy, if there's anything about knock and announce we know, it's that it's not clear. Is 3 seconds enough? Is 5 seconds enough? Is 10 seconds enough? And so I think the court is whistling past the graveyard a little bit and saying, well, we don't know any reason why civil remedies won't work, but do I think they'll work? No.
Another possibility, and I suppose one that's particularly relevant for our listeners in Urbana, is the police review board. Perhaps if police don't follow regulations in their conduct of a search, even if the evidence is not excluded, the police review board might oversee their conduct and issue some kind of finding that would influence behavior in the future.
I think that's a great point, and the Supreme Court pointed to the presence of police review boards as being one reason why they took comfort from not applying the exclusionary rule. On the other hand, the same principle applies in police review boards. Do you discipline someone when it's a judgment call and they just got it wrong? Is 3 to 5 seconds enough? Well, I don't know. Probably not, but you only know when the court says so, and so the likelihood that the police will, at the time they're ready to go into your house, think, better hold off, police review board might wrap my knuckles later, doesn't seem realistic to me.
We have a caller on line 4.
Hello?
Yes, hello.
Oh, hi. Yeah, my question is this. In regards to things like torture and rendition or kidnapping, et cetera, how can it even be a question in anyone's mind when it is already in the Constitution that it's against the law to break conventions that we have signed on to, which is the Geneva Conventions? How can it even be a question?
Well, it is certainly true, as the caller points out, that the Constitution itself declares that the Constitution, laws, and treaties of the United States shall be the supreme law of the land. So you're quite right. The Constitution, laws, and treaties of the United States shall be the supreme law of the land. But to say that is not to decide the cases to which those particular treaties apply. And I think my interpretation is like yours. I would have interpreted, I think, the Geneva Conventions as applicable in this case, as the Supreme Court did. But that's not to say that there was not at least a plausible argument to be made that the Geneva Conventions were not applicable here because the detainees in question were not fighting in a formal battle, not represented on representing a particular nation involved in a traditional conflict. And so I agree with you that lawyers have to read provisions to determine in certain circumstances where they apply. And my own view is that the provisions were applicable. I guess the question is, how arguable a case was that? I think it is probably fair to characterize it as arguable in light of the fact that a variety of judges approached the question from a variety of different perspectives as this case worked its way up to the Supreme Court. Not only did the lawyers for the Bush administration stake out this position on the front end, and many people have criticized them for doing so, but also a 3-judge panel of the D.C. Circuit upheld the Guantanamo Bay detention and the use of military tribunals for detainees there against the argument for the application of the Geneva Conventions. And the position taken was that the conventions are applicable perhaps in certain circumstances but not judicially enforceable. So it may be the case that they bind but only bind to the extent that the president acting for the government of the United States chooses to recognize them as binding. And that's a complicated idea to convey, but the notion is that they wouldn't be judicially enforceable but would be enforceable by other branches of the government. And so that was the position, at least in part, that the government took in response to the claimed application of Geneva Conventions. And I think on some days I'm pretty much where you are, listener, on the question of interpretation. Andy?
Keep in mind also that at least in the most recent case, the Hamdan case that came out at the end of last month, the question, even if you get to the place where the Geneva Convention applies, the convention often speaks in very broad terms. You're exactly right on the torture stuff. That part is easy. But the procedures that military commissions or anyone else has to follow is not spelled out. It talks about those procedures that are common to civilized people. Now, we think we know what that means because we come from a tradition where you get a lawyer and you have access to the evidence and you can be in court. But it's not obvious what the terms of the convention mean. So there's really two steps. One, to get to the place where it applies at all. And then, again, not to quarrel with your point, of course, the torture part is easy. But then the second point is, even if the convention applies, it doesn't tell us, it doesn't answer the questions that often come before the court, as it wouldn't have in this case.
The second criminal procedure case that we wanted to look at was one dealing with consent searches. And that was an interesting factual dispute.
This was an interesting case, not only for the facts, but because of what it ended up being about. Husband and wife in a dispute. She calls the police. The police come to the home. She has some issues with her husband's behavior and says, he takes cocaine and I can show you the evidence. The police ask him, can we search your house? He says no. He's an attorney. The police ask her, hey, can we search your house? And she says yes. Very simple case. Whose consent wins? Does she get to consent to the search of her home, or does he get to veto any search? Can he deny consent to search the home, his home as well? The police go. They go into, as the facts describe it, his bedroom and get evidence of cocaine use. They get a warrant. And the next thing you know, this very simple case has produced, as one listener already knew, six opinions from eight justices about exactly what the rule of consent is. The court finally said he wins. He can keep people out of the house if he's in there and he objects. Not an unreasonable decision. In fact, instinctively, we may think, well, yeah, that's right. If two people disagree, you don't get to consent to search my house. What's interesting is that what the case became, it became about domestic violence, interestingly enough. Both the majority and the dissent talk at length about what the impact of this, what this consent rule will have on domestic violent cases, where she wants the police to come into the house, to use the stereotypical example, and he says no. What are the police to do? And so even a case that on its face had nothing to do with domestic violence and everything to do with just picking a rule ends up perhaps having farther-reaching implications than the parties anticipated.
As we look to the future, we see one in which perhaps Justice Kennedy will be playing an important role at the center of the court. I think we can see his role reflected in a number of the decisions that came down in the last term. He cast the deciding vote in the Texas voting district litigation, something we haven't had a chance to talk about at all this hour in any detail. He also cast the deciding vote in the environmental wetlands case, a case involving the interpretation of the Clean Water Act. There was a four-justice majority on one side and a four-justice dissenting group on the other, with Justice Kennedy in the middle concluding that wetlands were subject to regulation so long as there was some nexus to a waterway or to the waters of the United States. So increasingly it may be that Justice Kennedy will be playing that centrist role. Is that the way you see things developing, Andy?
Absolutely. He and Justice O'Connor in part defined the center when she was there. Now it's him. I may have the numbers a little bit off, but I think there were in the roughly 17 cases that were decided by a single vote, Justice Kennedy, I believe, was in the majority in 12 of them. So in other words, in close cases, he is most likely to be the one to decide who gets the majority and who gets the dissent.
And you have some familiarity with that role, having worked with Justice Powell, who often played that role back in the 80s.
Justice Powell was often the one who, whatever he thought, whichever group he joined, would be the majority. And so as a result, he would often end up writing the opinions in these closely contested cases, and I think Justice Kennedy will play that role in the years to come.
Well, perhaps we should look at a few of the cases that are dialed up for the coming year, and maybe we can get a sense of both what lies ahead and a sense of how Kennedy's influence might affect it.
Well, the court's docket for next year is not fixed yet, but they have granted some cases. Perhaps there's a partial birth abortion case on the docket. There is two combined cases talking about the ability of states to appoint high school students to certain public schools using race as a factor. So that'll bring the affirmative action at the high school level back into play, and how Justice O'Connor's absence and Justice Alito's presence will affect that is likely to be very large. I predict that those cases will be among the biggest of the next term.
And Justice Kennedy has not been a big supporter of affirmative action so far in his position on the court. Justice O'Connor, as you know, switched to join a five-justice majority to uphold affirmative action at the college level, but was not able to bring Justice Kennedy along. So it will be interesting to watch those cases.